I'll be reading from Ajahn Jeff's The Karma of Questions. It's called Five Piles of Bricks, The Khandhas as Burden and Path. Page 53. The Buddha's awakening gave him, among other things, a new perspective on the uses and limitations of words. He had discovered a reality, the deathless, that no words could describe. At the same time, he discovered that the path to awakening could be described, although it involved a new way of seeing and conceptualizing the problem of suffering and stress. Because ordinary concepts were often poor tools for teaching the path, he had to invent new concepts and to stretch pre-existing words to encompass those concepts so that others could taste awakening themselves. One of the new concepts most central to his teaching was that of the khandhas, which are most frequently translated into English as aggregates. Prior to the Buddha, the Pali word khanda had a very ordinary meaning. A khanda could be a pile, a bundle, a heap, a mass. It could also be the trunk of a tree. In his first sermon, the Buddha gave it a new psychological meaning, introducing the term clinging khandhas to summarize his analysis of the truth of stress and suffering. Throughout the remainder of his teaching career, he referred to these psychological khandhas time and again. Their importance in his teaching has thus been obvious to every generation of Buddhists ever since. Less obvious, though, has been the issue of how they are important. How should a meditator make use of the concept of the psychological khandhas? What questions are they meant to answer? The most common response to these questions is best exemplified by two recent scholarly books devoted to the subject. Both treat the khandhas as the Buddha's answer to the question, what is a person? To quote the jacket off of the first. If Buddhism denies a permanent self, how does it perceive identity? What we conventionally call a person can be understood in terms of five aggregates, the sum of which must not be taken for a permanent entity, since beings are nothing but an amalgam of ever-changing phenomena. Without a thorough understanding of the five aggregates, we cannot grasp the liberation process at work within the individual, who is, after all, simply an amalgam of the five aggregates. From the introduction to the other. The third key teaching is given by the Buddha in the context which he is asked about individual identity, when people want to know, quote, what am I? What is my real self? The Buddha says that individuality should be understood in terms of combination of phenomena which appear to form the psychological and mental continuum of an individual life. In such context, the human being is analyzed into five constituents, the panchakhanda, five aggregates. This understanding of the khandhas isn't confined to scholars. Among almost any modern Buddhist meditation teacher would explain the khandhas in a similar way. And it isn't a modern innovation. It was first proposed at the beginning of the Common Era in the commentaries to the early Buddhist canon. Both the Theravadin and the Sarvastivadin, which form the basis for Mahayana scholasticism. However, once the commentaries use the khandhas to define what a person is, they spawn many of the controversies that have plagued Buddhist thinking ever since. Quote, if a person is just khandhas, then what gets reborn? If a person is just khandhas and the khandhas are annihilated on reaching total nibbana, then isn't total nibbana the annihilation of the person? If a person is khandhas and khandhas are interrelated with other khandhas, how can one person enter nibbana without dragging everyone else along? End quote. A large part of the history of Buddhist thought has been the story of ingenious but unsuccessful attempts to settle these questions. It is instructive to note, though, that the Pali Canon never quotes the Buddha as trying to answer them. In fact, it never quotes him as trying to define what a person is at all. Instead, it quotes him as saying that to question yourself in any way is to limit yourself, and that the question, what am I, is best ignored. This suggests that he formulated the concept of the khandhas to answer other, different questions. If, as meditators, we want to make the best use of this concept, we should look at those original questions and determine how they apply to our practice. The canon depicts the Buddha as saying that he taught only two topics, suffering and the end of suffering. A survey of the Pali discourses shows him using the concept of the khandhas to answer the primary questions related to those topics. What is suffering? How is it caused? What can be done to bring those causes to an end? The Buddha introduced the concept of the khandhas in his first sermon in response to the first of these questions. His short definition of suffering was, quote, the five clinging khandhas. This is a fairly cryptic phrase and can be fleshed out by drawing on other passages in the canon. The five khandhas are bundles or piles of form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. None of the texts explain why the Buddha used the word khandha to describe these things. The meaning of a tree trunk may be relevant to the pervasive fire imagery in the canon, Nibbana being extinguishing of the fires of passion, aversion, and delusion, but none of the texts explicitly make this connection. The common and explicit image of the khandhas is burdensome. We can think of them as piles of bricks we carry on our shoulders. However, these piles are best understood not as objects, but as activities, for an important passage defines them in terms of their functions. Form, which covers physical phenomena of all sorts, both within and without the body, wears down or deforms. Feeling feels pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure nor pain. Perception labels or identifies objects. Consciousness cognizes the six senses, counting the intellect as the sixth, along with their objects. Of the five khandhas, fabrication is the most complex. Passages in the canon define it as intention, but includes a wide variety of activities, such as attention, evaluation, and all the active processes of the mind. It is also the most fundamental khandha, for its primary activity is to take the potential for the experience of form, feeling, etc., coming from past actions, and turn it into the actual experience of those things in the present moment. Thus, intention is an integral part of our experience of all the khandhas. An important point, for this means that there is an element of intention in all suffering. This opens the possibility that suffering can be ended by changing our intentions or abandoning them entirely, which is precisely the point of the Buddha's teaching. To understand how this happens, we have to look more closely at how suffering arises, or in other words, how khandhas become clinging khandhas. When khandhas are experienced, the process of fabrication normally doesn't simply stop there. If attention focuses on the khandhas' attractive features, beautiful forms, pleasant feelings, etc., it can give rise to passion and delight. This passion and delight can take many forms, but the most tenacious is the habitual act of fabricating a sense of me or mine, identifying with a particular khandha or a set of khandhas, or claiming possession of it. This sense of me and mine is rarely static. It roams like an amoeba, changing its contours as it changes location, sometimes expansive, sometimes contracted. It can view itself as an individual, as identical with a khandha, as possessing a khandha, as existing within a khandha, or having a khandha existing within itself. At times feeling finite, at times feeling infinite. Whatever shape it takes, it's always unstable and insecure, for the khandhas providing its food are simply activities and functions, inconstant and insubstantial. In the words of the canon, the khandhas are like foam, like a mirage, like the bubbles formed when rain falls on water. They're heavy only because the iron grip of trying to cling to them is burdensome. As long as we're addicted to passion and delight in these activities, as long as we cling to them, we're bound to suffer. The Buddhist approach to ending this clinging, however, is not simply to drop it. As with any addiction, the mind has to be gradually weaned away. Before we can reach the point of no intention, where we're totally freed from the fabrications of khandhas, we have to change our intentions toward the khandhas so as to change their functions. Instead of using them for the purpose of constructing a self, we use them for the purpose of creating a path to end of suffering. Instead of carrying piles of bricks on our shoulders, we take them off and lay them along the ground as pavement. The first step in this process is to use the khandhas to construct the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. For example, right concentration. We maintain a steady perception focused on an aspect of form, such as the breath, and use directed thought and evaluation, which count as fabrications, to create feelings of pleasure and refreshment, which we spread throughout the body. In the beginning, it's normal that we experience passion and delight for these feelings, and that consciousness follows along in line with them. This helps get us absorbed into mastering the skills of concentration. Once we've gained the sense of strength and well-being that comes with mastering these skills, we can proceed to the second step, attending to the drawbacks of even the refined khandhas we experience in concentration, so as to undercut the passion and delight we might feel for them. At this point, he quotes an unreferenced sutta. Quote, suppose that an archer or an archer's apprentice were to practice on a straw man or mound of clay, so that after a while he could become able to shoot long distances, to fire accurate shots in rapid succession, and to pierce great masses. In the same way, there is the case where a monk enters and remains in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. He regards whatever phenomenon there that are connected with form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a disintegration, a void, not self. Similarly with all other levels of jhana. The various ways of fostering dispassion are also khandhas, khandhas of perception. A standard list includes the following: the perception of inconstancy, the perception of not self, the perception of unattractiveness, the perception of drawbacks, which are the diseases which the body is subject, the perception of abandoning, the perception of distaste for every world, the perception of the undesirability of all fabrications. One of the most important of these perceptions is that of not self. When the Buddha first introduced the concept of not self in his second sermon, he also introduced a way of strengthening its impact with a series of questions based around the khandhas. Taking each khandha in turn, he asked, is it constant or inconstant? Inconstant. And is that which is inconstant stressful or pleasurable? Stressful. And is it fitting to regard that which is inconstant, stressful, subject to change as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No. These questions show the complex role the khandhas play in the second step of the path. The questions themselves are khandhas of fabrication, and they use the concept of the khandhas to destruct any passion and delight that might center on the khandhas and create suffering. Thus, in this step, we use khandhas that point out the drawback of khandhas. If used skillfully, though, these perceptions and fabrications can simply replace passion with its mirror image, aversion. This is why they have to be based on the first step of well-being constructed in jhana, and coupled with the third step, the perception of dispassion and cessation that incline the mind to the deathless. Quote, this is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. In effect, these are perception khandhas that point the mind beyond all khandhas. The texts say that this three-step process can lead to one of two results. If, after undercutting passion and delight for the khandhas, the mind contains any residual passion for perception of the deathless, it will attain the third level of awakening called non-return. If passion and delight are entirely eradicated, though, all clinging is entirely abandoned. The intentions that fabricate khandhas are dropped, and the mind totally released. The bricks of the pavement have turned into a runway, and the mind has taken off. Into what? The authors of the discourses seem unwilling to say, even to the extent of describing it as a state of existence, non-existent, neither, or both. As one of the discourses states, the freedom lying beyond the khandhas also lies beyond the realm of which language properly applies. There is also the very real practical problem that any preconceived notion of the freedom, if clung to as a perception conda, could easily act as an obstacle to its attainment. Still, there is also the possibility that if properly used, such a perception conda might act as an aid on the path. So the discourses provide hints in the form of similes regarding to total freedom as the unfashioned, the end, the effluentless, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, permanence, the undecaying, the featureless, non-elaboration, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, soulless, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, the secure, security, unbinding, the unafflicted, the passionless, the pure, release, non-attachment, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge, the ultimate. Other passages mentioned a consciousness in this freedom. Quote, without feature or surface, without end, luminous all around. End quote. Lying outside of time and space, experienced when the sixth sense spheres stop functioning. In this, it differs from the consciousness conda, which depends on the sixth sense spheres, and can be described in such terms as near or far, past, present, or future. Consciousness without feature is thus the awareness of awakening, and the freedom of this awareness carries over even when the awakened person returns to ordinary consciousness. As the Buddha said of himself, quote, freed, disassociated, and released from form the Tathagata dwells with unrestricted awareness. Freed, disassociated, and released from feeling, perception, fabrications, consciousness, birth, aging, death, suffering and stress, defilement, the Tathagata dwells with unrestricted awareness. This shows again the importance of bringing the right questions to the teaching on the khandhas. If you use them to define what you are as a person, you tie yourself down to no purpose. The questions keep piling on, but if you use them to put an end to suffering, your questions fall away and you're free. You never again cling to the khandhas and no longer need to use them to end your self-created suffering. As long as you're still alive, you can employ the khandhas as needed for whatever skillful uses you see fit. And after that, you're liberated from all uses and needs, including the need to find words to describe that freedom to yourself or to anyone else.
Any questions, comments? Half expecting the earth to shake.
No, it's a wonderful, very clear, very precise. It's important to recollect that the, of course, that was the content of the second discourse of the Buddhas, were the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and all five of the first five disciples were liberated listening to that, so, getting that recognition that say, viewing the khandhas from a place of truth, suffering, end of suffering, as opposed to a basis for identity. It's an important distinction.
I'm curious if there is, because Ajahn Jeff cites the commentaries as using khandhas to answer that, the question, what is a person?
Mm-hmm.
But is Ajahn Jeff, is this sort of the first voice in a couple thousand years to propose that's may not be the case, or is there another sort of tradition that's not what Jeff is drawing on?
Yeah, the Buddha. That's people have been going back to the Buddha. I mean, that's been the source of kind of the renewal or kind of continuation of the. We practice lineages for a long, long time.
It mentioned intention, and could you talk a little bit about practicing with intention? about like how to watch it or how to work with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things is good to sometimes coming back to the Pali and having a little bit of knowledge of the Pali terminology, so that the word that it that volition or that intention is referencing is jetana, and jetana is both intention, although I think that's in English that has a narrow application. Perhaps a better term in English is volition. So it's like the kind of that movement of mind, the impulse of the mind, the mind creating a direction for itself, leaning towards something. It's more of an energetic as opposed to a, because the intention is sort of like a clearly formed rational process. So, oh, I didn't have the intention to do this. The underlying impulse is really more what jetana is having us investigate. So in terms of investigation of jetana, to be tuning into the mood of the mind and the leaning of the mind, the impulse of the mind, what's it directing its attention towards? So I'm getting a sense of that, and that's actually I said like when Ajahn Chah speaks of the benefit or the function, the purpose of, say, of precepts, the function or the benefit is that it helps us to understand the intention or the volition, understand jetana. Because it's like we create a clarity in our conduct, and then it mirrors back. Where's our mind moving towards? What's it being drawn to? So then we start to understand jetana more clearly. Mindfulness as a tool or in terms of creating a sense of stillness or clarity, then within that stillness and clarity, then we can start to see where's our mind moving, what's pulling it, what's drawing it. That's jetana.
Is volition the same as becoming or an aspect of becoming?
It'd be an aspect of becoming. The becoming is much more of a moving towards a fully formed sense of person or being.
It's further in.
Yeah, it's a little bit further
along. Volition is like the first lean, and then
it's
like
that
falling
first lean
into it and becoming.
Yes.
This kind of seems like it's kind of related to that, but as I was listening to this talk, I was kind of like, wanted to ask your opinion about like how to listen to these Dhamma talks, because they're very different. It's like Ajahn Jeff, like when he gives these meditations and meditations books, those are from talks, and he often says like with that, like when he's speaking, if the mind gets sort of intrigued by an idea, just to go with that and not worry about the talk.
Oh,
And you know, just use that as an entrance into the meditation. Whereas, like the island in this talk is more of an essay.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I found my mind continue like, oh, that's an interesting idea, and I started mulling it over. But then I'm completely lost in the talk.
Right. Well, I mean, part of it is just say understanding volition. What's pulling the mind? Because it is, because you can. I think you know, in listening to. To you know whether it's an essay or whether it's an actual talk, yeah, you want to be using the sound and the content to help settle the mind. And there's a certain reflection going on, but it's much more trying to tune into the feeling of what's trying to be conveyed And what's important in this, in terms of, yeah, say, the project of freeing the heart from suffering?
Yeah. So, in the process of trying to create some separation between, like, the self and then the different khandhas, in addition to the volition, like the leaning away, mm-hmm. are there any other tools or things you like suggest that can like, help that from like the act of becoming?
A lot of it's just the just tuning into awareness, because on a certain level as well. I mean, you don't have to separate yourself and khandhas because that it doesn't exist anyway. I mean, in the sense of that it's a conception that we hold, and that's formed through volition. So a lot of it is just learning how to settle the mind, let the mind get some space, and recognize what's actually arising. What's the mind leaning towards? What's it trying to get? What angle is it? What's it angling for now? Mm-hmm. So what's it trying to get? What's it trying to get away from? That's usually the best sort of way. So what's it trying to get? And what's it trying to get away from? That's a really good kind of standard to sort of start to get a feel for. Well, where's the mind going? And how can I just let that settle? Come back to a place of awareness. Yeah.
That sort of process really reminds me like the Anattalakkhana Sutta, that central piece being the questioning.
Right.
When the Buddha gives like talks, or when he instructed his monks on anatta, you get this sense of encouraging them to think for themselves and to ask them these questions and to, yeah. It's not just a philosophical thing. It's like,
yeah, you're not sort of memorizing a philosophical doctrine. There's an inquiry, and also like that book is actually the karma of questions. It says how do we question things skillfully, so that because there's certainly like Ajahn Chah, and you read his biography, or when you read some of those, it comes across more in the biography when he talks about his own practice. But that was formed a large part of his book, really bringing up questions in his mind, and it's part of the exploration of Dhamma. It's questioning skillfully here. That inquiry is not just a restless proliferation. It's important to have a skillful way of questioning, so that it highlights restlessness or doubt or desire or ill will or the sense of self or the sense of attraction or the sense of attachment. So that it's a question that actually helps shine a light on. Okay.